Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the effect on dating, relationships, and families when women bring home more money than their male partners? With American women filling 57% of seats in university undergraduate classes and earning a majority of PhDs and master's degrees, it should come as little surprise that nearly 4 in 10 working wives in the U.S. currently out-earn their husbands. And that is giving rise to new questions about the relative importance of partners' careers and to new freedoms for women in choosing who, when, and whether to marry and how to live once they do. Liza Mundy is a fellow at the New America Foundation and a reporter for The Washington Post. Her new book is called The Richer Sex: How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. Liza, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So we are not here today to celebrate the end of the wage gap that still exists between men and women for doing the exact same work. How is it then that 38% of married women today earn more than their husbands?
Yes, it's really striking. Just as you say, there's still a so-called gender wage gap, and we know that women working full-time make 81% of what men make, and that's looking at women and men in all professions. So it has something to do with the fact that women are still often in different professions than men are. And yet you see this extraordinary transformation within marriage, that the percentage, just as you say, of working wives out-earning husbands, it's now close to 40%. That percentage has been rising steadily since the late 1980s when the government started tracking it. If it continues to rise at the same pace, then by 2030, a majority of working wives would be out earning their husbands. And one thing that it means is that women may be supporting households on less than a man would make, perhaps, in the same job. Hmm.
And you call this the big flip because from time immemorial, it was far more common and certainly more expected that husbands would be the primary, if not sole, breadwinners.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this has been the expectation for hundreds and hundreds of years. And in fact, I mean, looking back at the history, which was fascinating, I was reminded that even 150 years ago in this country and many other countries, once a woman got married, and that, of course, was women's destiny and pretty much the only life choice available to them, she lost control of her property. She did not have the right to own her own wages. And when this started to change, there were people who felt that this would threaten the entire fabric of society. I have a quote in my book from the London Times, very disturbed at the possibility of women gaining the right to their own property in marriage and saying that it would destroy marriage, which consisted of subordination on the one side and authority on the other. And they were worried that when a wife has the right to own her own property, what is there to prevent her from going where she likes and doing what she pleases?
What indeed?
What indeed? And so, you know, and even after that happened, we entered the industrial era where man was the wage earner. He was the breadwinner. That was the source of men's identity as adults, providing for their families, regardless of whether or not they liked their job. And, I mean, the gender wage gap that we just talked about, it's really a vestige of the way the workplace was organized back in the 1930s and 40s and beyond, where there was a two-tier wage scale. Women doing the same job as men made less than men. Everybody accepted that. Women couldn't advance in the workplace. There were bars on employment for married women often. So we're still seeing the vestige of that. I think, you know, many families still retain this expectation that the man is a breadwinner, even though, you know, increasingly that's not the case, and many workplaces do too.
I'll tell you what fascinates me about this trend, Liza, is that in some ways it feels very new. On the other hand, before the Industrial Revolution, when so much of the world earned its living in agrarian lifestyles, women may not have had rights to their own property, but there's no question that they contributed to earning what the household needed to earn in order to survive. I mean, men and women may have done different jobs, but they had to work just as hard.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in a more agriculture-based economy, the women would be providing, they would be performing tasks at home, sometimes the same tasks that the men were, and sometimes, obviously, different tasks. But just as you say, it was more of a mutual endeavor. But again, I mean, let there be no mistake that the husband was the member of the family who was the head of the household, and the one, you know, for years and years with the legal right to, you know, whatever profits they were making from that endeavor.
What accounts for women's overtaking men in academic achievement?
You know, it's really interesting. A number of different factors. Obviously, campuses opened up to women that had been closed to them in the 1970s, and women really took advantage of that very quickly. Some people attribute this, economists attribute this in part convincingly to the birth control pill and reliable contraception that gave women an economic incentive to invest in their education and their professional future, knowing that they could go to school, get a graduate degree, and have a career that would be less likely to be interrupted by an unplanned pregnancy. There's a very convincing paper that shows that 25% of the narrowing of the gender wage gap over the decades can be attributable to better contraception options for women. So that's one part of it. Obviously, the social and cultural changes of the 1970s and 80s created really a radical change in the way that women looked at their futures and their likelihood of being employed. It's also interesting, though, there have been some recent changes. Studies show that in the working class, boys are still pressured to leave home, to leave school after high school, and to look for a job because boys are thought of as providers, and there's actually family pressure to leave school, to not go to college, and to, you know, get whatever job is available. And we know that because of changes in our economy, that high-paying jobs for male high school graduates are waning. I mean, we saw this in the recession, but it's been happening for longer than that. So this is really not a good life trajectory for many of those boys, whereas the girls now are being pressured by their families to stay in school. They're told, you know, you could be a single mom someday, you could be divorced, you've got to be able to support yourself, maybe support a child. And studies show that families are actually investing in their daughter's education and are more likely to pay for their college than they are for a son. So it's interesting that there's this this change in families willing to invest in their children. It used to be that a family would be more likely to pay for a boy's education than a girl. And that seems to have flipped in a way that's disadvantageous for boys right now.
So we'll talk about family dynamics in a minute, but this trend also has remarkable implications for single women in relationships. For one thing, the stigma that once existed for the successful career woman in terms of finding a mate is falling away very quickly.
Yes, studies show that when men, and this was actually done at the University of Texas at Austin by some psychologists, when men are asked to rank the traits that they consider most important in a mate, domestic skills has plummeted in their rankings. Mm-hmm. Virginity has actually plummeted. Financial prospects has risen. So women, you know, the fact that a woman is educated and has good earning prospects is a plus now for her in terms of attracting men. But women often don't realize that yet. And actually, I spent a lot of time reporting in Texas, this book. I have a lot of stories in the book, and a lot of them are set in Texas. And I interviewed a university vice president at one of the UT colleges. And when she was on the dating market, she wouldn't let men walk her to her car because she drives a BMW. And she was afraid that that would put them off. And she also, when men would ask her what she does, she would say, well, I work at the university. And when they would ask, well, are you a professor? She would say, well, no, I work in administration. Hmm. So it was really interesting as I did interviews to find out sort of the strategies that women have devised to appear not threatening on the dating market.
And it turns out maybe they don't need to do that anymore.
Maybe not so much. I mean, it depends. Obviously, in more traditional cultures, it still can be a problem. I spent a lot of time in Deep South Texas among Latina women who are out-achieving men academically at an even higher rate. And in, you know, the more traditional the community, the harder this can be. But in general, yes, I think women are working harder than they need to try to be conventionally feminine and to seem, I mean, maybe needier than they really are.
On the other hand, men's willingness to, as you say, marry up economically is not a new phenomenon. Not only did everybody watch Downton Abbey, where the entire place was originally rescued by a woman's wealth, but at the end of World War I, the supply of eligible men was severely limited in certain places, and men were delighted to find women with great financial prospects.
Yes, and you know, Downton Abbey comes up a lot because it isn't, you know, for those young women, marriage really was the sort of only life acceptable life prospect. And as you say, the estate was saved by a woman's wealth, but she lost the ability to control it after she married. But anyway, it's really interesting. Economists are looking at this a lot, men's and women's willingness to quote-unquote marry up or marry down, because we're in this unprecedented situation where we have more female college graduates than male, and so every woman college graduate, if she wanted to marry a male college graduate, can't anymore. Mm-hmm. So an economist at Stanford University looked at France after World War I, when, you know, obviously the country had lost millions of men in the Great War, and some regions had lost more men than others. And they looked at regions with high mortality rates, which were therefore suffering a shortage of men, and they found that these men were able to marry better than they would have been ordinarily. They were able to marry laterally or marry up. And they were very willing to do so. I mean, you know, we respond to economic incentives, and men given the chance to better their prospects, to, you know, enter maybe even a different social class, were quite happy to do that.
And of course, on the other side of the coin, women need to be willing to, and I hate the phrase, honestly, in both contexts, but marry down. Women have to be open to the idea of marrying someone who will not earn as much as they do.
Right, someone who will not earn as much as they do, or maybe doesn't have the same level of education that they do. And this is a really new phenomenon for college-educated women, and I talk to them a lot about that. I would say, you know, would you marry a man who didn't go to college? And they would say, wow, I was just talking about that over dinner last night with my girlfriends, or I was just talking about that in my college dorm. And by and large, women were skeptical about this. I mean, studies show that women are doing it, that it is happening, and in fact, a woman is more likely to marry a man with less education than a man is these days. Mm-hmm. But women still have, they really do have to overcome an initial reluctance, because young women think of a college education as a proxy for drive and ambition and the willingness to better yourself. But I also saw some very happy relationships where young women had married men who were willing to invest in the woman's career. I interviewed a young woman who's a law student in Vermont, and she's married to a man who's a carpenter. He didn't go to college, and he is working to put her through law school exactly the way that that wives used to do for husbands. And she values all sorts of new qualities. She values his adaptability, his domestic skills, his willingness to share the workload at home. She values the fact that she can come home and not have to talk about the law, mm-hmm. and not be around, you know, a fellow law student. So women do need to realize that, you know, that men can bring more to the table than simply earnings. But I did see some very happy relationships where women had figured this out and figured out that the way to realize their own ambitions was to sign on with a supportive partner.
And I guess they still have to convince friends and relatives that this is a good idea.
Yes, that was so interesting. I mean, you know, stigma is very profound, and it can be found in a lot of different places. There are still churches that teach that, you know, the husband is the household leader and the household provider, and that the wife should be submissive, and that she, you know, her place is in the home. And couples in religious communities are having to sort of find ways to adjust this mindset. I mean, in some couples, the compromise will be that the husband is directing the wife to earn, and so he's therefore the household leader. But I talked to couples also who were really happy with their own balance. Maybe, you know, the wife was working and very happy in the workplace. The husband was more comfortable at home, but he felt stigmatized by their in-laws.
Let me jump in here, Liza. We have to take a quick break. Yeah. My guest is Liza Mundy. We're talking about her new book, The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Washington Post reporter Liza Mundy is my guest. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the new book, The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. Join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. And before we had to stop, Liza, you were telling us that there were some happy couples that you met whose in-laws were still not delighted by this unequal relationship.
Yes, and it can afflict both men and women in relationships, as readers have made clear to me. I wrote about some husbands who were very supportive and happy stay-at-home dads or secondary earners, very supportive of their wives, who nevertheless were made to feel stigmatized by their wife's parents, by their in-laws. One husband actually here in Washington said, you know, they view me as the freeloader. They view me as the leech, like I'm living off her earnings. And they were ignoring the fact that he was really facilitating his wife's career. And similarly, you know, women who are working and earning can be made to feel stigmatized by their in-laws and sometimes their own parents, you know, that they're not spending enough time at home, that they're spending too much time away from their children. And I learned that one recipe for happiness, as couples find their way forward, is an extended family that is supportive of these new arrangements.
I'm curious to know how this dynamic manifests itself in terms of people's expectations, members of these couples' expectations of who's in charge of the laundry, who actually cooks dinner at the end of the day, and whether there are, you found women who were like, yes, I guess I do want him to cook dinner.
That's right. I think, you know, what's interesting about this is it's opening a whole new set of questions. And I think that the feminist argument needs to, the feminist conversation needs to address some of these new questions. We know, believe it or not, that men are doing much more housework than they used to. Men's housework load has increased. Women's housework load has decreased over the past several decades. And, you know, traditionally we've argued that when a man is the breadwinner, when he's the household breadwinner, this should not buy him out of helping out at home, right? We've been arguing this. Men need to unload the dishwasher. They need to learn how to do that. They need to diaper the kids, et cetera. And so after 20 or 30 years of making this argument, many women now who are the breadwinners are coming home and saying, gosh, you know, I've had kind of a tough work day. Do I have to pitch in? I interviewed one young woman in California who's an engineer, and she was working very hard to support her household. Her husband was out of work. They had to get married sooner than they had expected to put him on her health insurance. She was feeling all of the breadwinning stresses that men have traditionally felt, and she was working as hard as she could. And he, meanwhile, was doing all the cooking and all the cleaning and taking care of their pets. And even when he got a new job, he wasn't earning as much as she was. And she said, you know, I'm struggling with this. It's not 50-50. I'm not doing my share. But on the other hand, I'm making more. And does it really have to be 50-50? So it was interesting to hear these questions kind of being reopened and reconsidered from a new vantage point.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak first with Ashley Dawn in Dallas. Hi, Ashley Dawn.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Well, I was just calling because I actually met a man who made a great living, and the reason I married him is because I liked the fact that I could just come home and relax and not have to think about what I did for work, and he was also willing to put me through a grad school. And so I found him great, and my family didn't really approve, but I went with it. And then a few years later, it actually ended up being the end of our marriage because of the fact that I found that, you know, he didn't want to read a book, or he didn't want to talk about the political scene. He didn't want to have interesting conversations. A lot of the friends I've met in my career in grad school, things like that, he no longer related to. And so my marriage actually ended up ending for completely different reasons than I entered into the marriage. So that's why I found this such an interesting conversation to have.
Hmm. What do you think about that, Liza?
Well, that is instructive. I mean, a lot of the women that I talk to, college graduates, would say, you know, I'm leery of marrying someone who didn't go to college because I worry that we won't be able to have, you know, those kinds of conversations. And so her point is well taken. I also found that in some successful couples, the wife's successfully managed to get her husband enrolled in college and get him through and kind of inspire him to improve himself. So that's one option. In the other couples I talked to where it was working, they had some outside realm where they could, you know, sort of be together and relate, like, you know, outdoor pursuits like hiking or something that was a completely separate realm where they felt like they were matching and communing. But I have to say, yeah, her example is instructive. I mean, women do expect when they get home from work to have someone who will talk to them at the end of the day.
Let's talk about traditional notions, and these are outmoded today, but they still exist as things people are familiar with. Traditional notions of how women would attract a mate, the things they would do in terms of their physical appearance and accommodating their potential mate's taste in things, and how those are switching now that women are earning more in some cases.
Right. Well, there's this traditional idea, and it doesn't sound very romantic, but I think there's some truth to it, that people realize, particularly in a marriage, that you have to bring something to the relationship. So if a man was bringing the earnings, then a woman might be bringing her beauty. I mean, she might, you know, really groom herself so that she looked good on his arm and enhance his professional standing, or she would bring sexual services, or she would bring her domestic skills. And so now that those tables are turning a little bit, I do think that men are bringing some of these same qualities like domestic skills and beauty, I think. I interviewed a number of young women in Atlanta. We know now that women under 30 in most American cities who are single out-earn their male peers, and Atlanta is among the top cities. So I talked to some young women earners, and it was interesting. First of all, their expectations of beauty in a mate, in a boyfriend were pretty high. I mean, they were pretty physically picky. And yet at the same time, they were not willing to modify their appearance for a boyfriend if it seemed unreasonable. I mean, they were very, you know, they wanted to look good and they worked out and they were very, you know, attractive. But if a boyfriend asked them to wear more makeup, or if he asked them to lose weight, they didn't feel like they had to do this. And one woman said, you know, I have a rule. If you think that I was hot when you met me, you don't get to change the rules later. And I would never suggest that, you know, economic empowerment cures women of body image anxieties, but it did seem to make a difference in terms of their willingness to, you know, to work on themselves at a boyfriend's request if they felt like it was an unreasonable request. If they felt like they were being made into, like, you know, a trophy physically, they would push back against that.
Liza Mundy is my guest. Her new book is called The Richer Sex. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Liza, is there such a thing as a trophy husband now?
I think there is. And you know, he has all sorts of different qualities. I mean, beauty can be one of those things. As I mentioned, one of these young women in Atlanta had become obsessed with her boyfriend's jean size because he had come here from another country and he was gaining weight on American portions, mm-hmm. and she was very disturbed by that. And so, you know, she had physical expectations, for sure. I think, you know, and we see this in popular culture also. You know, the boyfriend, the husband who's willing to wear the snuggly and carry the baby, the guys who are pushing strollers now. I interviewed one young woman who works in New York, and she walks every day through a park in Brooklyn that's just full of men in strollers. And that's what she wants. That's what she wants in a husband, not necessarily a stay-at-home husband, but, you know, she was talking about her own father and how distant he was from their family. Her parents were divorced, and she lived in Florida, and he was what they called a Disney dad. He would see his kids, you know, to take them to Disney World, but not really be bonded. And I think, you know, the trophy husband these days is a man who is willing to push the stroller and be bonded with his children and cook. And actually, you know, men are spending much more time in the kitchen than they used to. And I think there's a kind of display cooking that's going on now that it's almost a form of sexual display, men cooking very showy meals because it is a successful way to entice a woman.
And what about sex and about who makes the decision as to whether or not this is a night for romance?
Yeah, so obviously sex is a complicated topic, and you know, different couples have different dynamics. But I did interview people about this, and I tried to interview experts about this. You know, if a man's not the provider, will a woman's sexual attraction change? Or just as you say, will the decision-making change? And I did interview couples, mature couples, where the wife had started pulling ahead. And this was problematic in part because they didn't feel like they could talk about it. I mean, if she was pulling ahead and they didn't quite know how to deal with it, and if she came home at the end of the day and didn't feel like she could talk about her raise or her success at work, and didn't feel like he would praise her or share in her happiness, that was a real recipe for disaster sexually as well. And I interviewed a couple of women who whose partners actually left them or cheated on them for women who seemed more conventionally feminine. So it can be problematic, but I get back to the idea, I think in the long run for couples and for women, you know, to be economically empowered in your relationship is better than the reverse. And I think it gives women more physical self-confidence, more sexual self-confidence. And the young women that I talked to who were, you know, self-sufficient and didn't need to commit to a relationship right away, they didn't, unlike the young women in Downton Abbey, they didn't need to rush into marriage. I think it gives young women a chance to, you know, to have different relationships with different men and see who's willing to be a good sexual partner and a good domestic partner. And ultimately, I believe it's an empowering thing for women and a good thing for couples.
Back to the phones now. Next on the line, we have Chris in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My comment was, I mean, we're both in our mid-40s, and we've been married, well, close to 14 years. When we first met, I mean, she made a little bit more, maybe $20,000 or $30,000 more than I did, and it wasn't a big deal. But through her career, right now she probably makes 10 times what I make. And it took me a long time, even though she told me this for years and years and years and years, that she goes, you know, it's not, you know, my money, it's our money. So, and it took me a long time to really understand that from, you know, being a, you know, mid-40s male, just that I'm not the breadwinner. And for the last, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, I've taken some time off and am doing what you're talking about, spending time with my kids. I take them to school, pick them up from school, take them to, you know, tennis, golf, you know, parties, which I don't like to go to. I don't do the cooking though. But I understand what you're talking about. And it took me a long time to understand that, okay, I'm never going to make the amount of money that she makes. It's just not going to happen. She went to law school. I only did 2 years of college, but she says, I make her feel safe. And I'm the one that does all the house maintenance. And and we get along great. I mean, 14 years, I mean, and I'm not planning on leaving her unless she gets tired of me.
Well, I'm glad it's working for you, Chris. Do you want to respond to that, Liza?
Oh, yeah, there's so many things in what he said. I mean, the idea that he makes her feel safe is so interesting because when anthropologists look at different cultures and what are the qualities, you know, the essential qualities of masculinity, yeah, providing has been one of them, but protection, procreation also, but protection has traditionally been a really significant part of masculinity, and there are all sorts of ways to make your wife feel safe and protected. And I would really take what she says seriously. I mean, I interviewed prominent public women whose husbands would go with them to events and rescue them from conversations with admirers, you know, and found this as a way to make their wife feel protected and safe. And I think that's very important and that he should believe what she says. I also interviewed adult children of breadwinning moms who were so happy to have had that time with their dads. You know, to have been picked up at school by their father was like a prestigious thing, you know, one young woman said it made me feel really special that my dad was around all the time. So he should value what he's doing. It is important to his children. And taking your kids to those tennis lessons and those golf lessons, I mean, you're preparing your kids for the future and you're giving them skills, you know, that could get a college scholarship or just make them be happy in life. And also that his wife says that this is our money and not my money is such an important thing for her to say, because women still, studies show, are inclined to think of their earnings as my money, because women have been raised to think our earnings are like our pin money, they're our shoe money, they're our special money to spend on ourselves. And and they found that when women are breadwinners, they're more likely to try to retain control over household financial decisions and household purchases. They still tend to think of their money as my money. And so that this wife is thinking of it as our money is also something that, you know, that they should both value, because it's an important ingredient. So it's definitely true that men's, you know, identity has come from providing, and also that we are very comparative. You know, when we're looking at our success in life, we tend to compare ourselves to other people. And married couples are now in a position of comparing themselves to each other, and it's harder on men because men have always expected to earn more than their spouse. So if you're gauging your success at life, and if you're looking at other people's salaries, your spouse's salary is the one you're most likely to know. And studies also show that this comparison is harder on men, that even when women draw even with their husband, they think, well, I'm doing pretty well, you know, I haven't expected this. And right now it's harder on men, and it sounds like they're, you know, adjusting well, and even maybe better than he realizes.
I was interested to read that marriage rates are rising for high-income women and falling for those at the lower end of the spectrum. Just for purposes of this discussion, can you give us a sense in general terms of what high and low income mean?
Oh, yeah. This was a Hamilton Project study. And actually, I don't have those figures at the top of my head. But for women who are in the top, like, 5 percentile of earners, marriage rates have risen kind of strikingly.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I don't have the study in front of me, but I think we can imagine that if it's the top 5 percentile of earnings, it's got to be over $100,000.
Right.
And marriage rates are declining for men and women in most other earnings percentiles, but particularly among the poor and working class. I mean, this is where I think the change is most problematic, as because women are financially self-sufficient now, or more likely than they've been in the past to be self-sufficient, and because working class jobs are on the decline in this country, and a male high school graduate can no longer command the sort of high-paying industrial or labor work that he once could, women are making the decision not to marry. I mean, they're saying to themselves, I can support myself, I can support a child, but I don't want another dependent. And so, in part, I think that's why we're seeing a particular decrease in marriage in the working class. And it is something that ultimately we need to figure out a way to fix, because, you know, the children will lose touch with their fathers if the father can't provide and he's not married to the mother. Studies show that the children will lose touch with him.
Liza Mundy is here. Her new book is called The Richer Sex: How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Liza Mundy. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation and a reporter for The Washington Post. Her new book is called The Richer Sex: How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Malcolm on the line in Dallas. Hey, Malcolm.
Hi. Good conversation.
Thank you.
First, let me say that I'm not interested in any competition between males and females. I think it's great for our culture that women are progressing in this manner. I'm reminded, though, of the book Boys Adrift, written by Dr. Leonard Sachs. And he lists a number of things that are negatively impacting our boys' ability to excel in school and their subsequent ability to be economically successful. And I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with that book, and also if from flipping it around to the female's perspective, are there things in our education system now that are particularly suited for girls over boys?
Yes, I am familiar with the literature on boys, and you know, there's also a literature on girls, and there's this argument going on in some ways over who's more shortchanged in school. I mean, there have been reports on girls being shortchanged in school with the belief, you know, that they don't raise their hand as much or, you know, get called on as much. But I do tend to find more convincing the literature on the ways in which boys are at a disadvantage right now. I'm the parent of a boy and a girl. I've got two teenagers, and I've seen them go through, you know, the school system. And studies show that there are a number of factors about education today that favor girls. Because school and, you know, particularly kindergarten even, gets so academic so soon, and because so much emphasis is placed even at, in the early grades on reading and writing and you know, skills that by and large girls have at an earlier age, that, you know, even from the early grades, we know that boys are more likely to be held back in kindergarten. They're more likely to delay their entrance into kindergarten. Girls, you know, as you would predict, they're more likely to do their homework. They're more focused in the classroom. They tend to like school more than boys do. Having, you know, raised two kids through middle school, the level of organizational ability that middle school requires was just kind of exhausting for my household, particularly when my son was going through it, because it was hard for him, because that wasn't what he wanted to be doing. And so I do find the literature on ways in which boys are being are shortchanged to be more convincing these days. I mean, there are obviously aspects of schools that are hard for maybe both genders in different ways. But by and large, I think the literature is convincing that for girls, you know, sitting in the classroom, staying focused, being organized, is on balance easier.
Lisa, go ahead.
Well, and just the fact, and also the fact that boys mature a little bit later. So some of the things that come a little more earlier for girls, like, you know, writing the essays and the SATs, you know, boys are going to get there. They're just going to get there a few years later. But I think we also need to look, as I was saying earlier, at the message that families are sending.
So talk about this research that as women gain a foothold in certain traditionally male professions, medicine and law, at the same time men begin to find those careers less appealing overall. Now, that's not necessarily a causal relationship, but what can you tell us about that?
You know, it's so interesting. We talk a lot about the fact that women still aren't adequately represented, say, in, you know, in the CEO positions or on corporate boards or in politics, and that's true. But we tend to ignore these really interesting flips that are taking place in other professions. As you said, law and medicine are increasingly becoming feminized, and there are some medical specialties now, like pediatrics, OBGYN, internal medicine, that have many more young women in them than young men. And there are fields that have completely flipped, like psychology and also veterinary medicine. And economists have looked at why, and part of it has to do with the fact that women strategically see these as fields that offer more predictable work hours, sometimes because of changes in, for example, veterinary medicine has more emergency facilities now, and so at regular vet practices, the hours are more regular, so women understand, I could do this job and be a mother and, you know, and have a reasonable work schedule. But some economists have also looked at this idea of gender pollution, the idea that if too many women are in a veterinary medicine classroom, men won't even enter the classroom. It seems now like a female field, and that there's some stigma attached to it. Some sociologists have shown that men who do enter women's fields tend to be a little bit more stigmatized romantically, like men who are teachers or men who are nurses. So there are a lot of really interesting dynamics. I do wonder, though, whether fields like nursing that are seeing a lot more expansion in our new economy, whether they will become more attractive to men and get over this idea of gender pollution.
We have an email here from Nancy who writes, in 1979, when I started medical school in Texas, I could not get a student loan without a male co-signer. My husband was also a medical student with a heavier debt load, but his signature sufficed. Needless to say, things have changed, although I have to admit I find myself reacting in a somewhat judgmental way when I see professional women marrying less educated men.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's some of that stigma that hopefully will abate. I mean, again, I think our definition of trophy husband is evolving, and so maybe some of that stigma will. But that's fascinating that even in the late 70s, she had to get a man to co-sign her loan. But the medical field is changing in such interesting ways. I mean, again, when I was trying to take my son to the pediatrician for a checkup and he wanted a male doctor, our practice has trouble. They had to bring in a doctor from retirement because all of their new doctors are female.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Adam in Dallas. Hey, Adam.
Hi, Chris. This is really particularly interesting for me, especially the last topic about career paths. I'm a firefighter, highly masculine career with not a lot of influence from women, more so now. But the woman that I'm currently with is, we both have children, and it seems like I provide a bit of security, just my ability to help around the house as a firefighter, cleaning, cooking, being able to do things.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand where we come together, but your first caller being a woman saying her marriage ended, and then your second caller being a man saying he provides a sense of security to his wife, makes me wonder about the success rate for these kinds of marriages where the men marry up. I was wondering if your guest could address that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not convinced that the literature on this is very good, because there's some studies, you know, from like the 80s and 90s that show that divorce rates are slightly higher when a woman marries a man with less education than she has. But our social norms are changing so rapidly, and the pool of people who are in this situation is changing. You know, it's a bigger pool now. So I'm not convinced that studies, you know, say from 20 years ago are really that valid for, and in fact, some of the few academics who are tracking this believe also that it's changing, and that marriages, say, where the man has less education than women are no longer any more at risk. I mean, there are also studies that show that that in a marriage where a woman earns more, if it gets to be significantly more, like more than 60%, the marriages are at a slightly higher risk of divorce. So that's been the consensus up until now, but part of that is also maybe due to something they call the independence effect, that when a woman is earning enough to get out of an unhappy marriage, she will. So it's very hard for economists to untangle, you know, when the woman's salary rises above 60% and they get a divorce, is it because that's made the marriage unhappy? Or is that because it was an unhappy marriage and now she can leave? We know in general that women are more likely to leave a marriage than men are. Men are more likely to stick it out. So there's a lot of contradictory research right now going on about this, even as I think our norms are changing very rapidly. I think it's hard to track it.
How sensitive or aware were the women that you spoke to, mostly women for this book, about the reality that this is a tough time for some men in terms of adjusting to the new dynamic?
Oh yeah, women are aware of that. I think, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the end of men or decline of men. And what's interesting is, you know, we talk about this periodically. Even back in the 50s, Look magazine was writing about the decline of the American male. So we always seem to think men are in decline. And I think one thing to remember about this past recession, in which 3/4 of the jobs lost were lost by men. Yes, there's a decline in traditional high-paying working-class jobs, but women have not caused that decline. And in fact, I would argue that women kept men from declining further, because during this recession, a lot of wives and a lot of girlfriends kept households afloat. And studies show that men, by and large, are appreciative of that and more comfortable than they say were, say, during the actual depression, when working wives were really stigmatized. So in general, I think women are aware that these can be tough times for men. And I think that's one reason why women, by and large, are often reluctant to acknowledge that they are the breadwinner in their relationship. And a lot of women think that they're the only person who is the breadwinner in her relationship. And in fact, it's obviously much more common than we realize. And I think it's important for women to talk about this. It's important for workplaces and managers to understand that women are the breadwinners often, and households depend on them, and that, you know, women need to be paid a breadwinner's wage.
Why do we still see such an uneven distribution of women in CEO-level jobs, particularly given the fact that women-owned businesses are certainly growing at a rapid rate?
Women-owned businesses are, and interestingly, one reason for that is because if women feel that an institutional workplace is not going to accommodate their family, you know, their family schedule, women will just start a business instead. They'll become self-employed or small business owners to give themselves that flexible schedule, and often that's working for them. I think in terms of CEOs, I mean, we know that the MBA, more so than law and medicine, the hours for an MBA who wants to succeed in the business world are really killer hours, and that's very difficult. I think it's probably the highest hurdle still for women. But I also would argue that for a woman to really succeed at the highest level, she really needs a stay-at-home spouse in order to have a children and succeed at the high level. And you do see the women CEOs who are there often do have stay-at-home husbands. I mean, it's very hard for a couple to both be charging ahead at the same pace. And those women who are at the top, you know, have made peace with that, and their husbands have made peace with it too, and often those men have really facilitated their wives' careers. So I think, you know, we're going to need some more supportive stay-at-home husband spouses as well in order to get more women to propel them to the top, particularly in the corporate world.
And I guess we also need to see the stigma truly fall away for stay-at-home husbands. But to be fair, there is some degree of stigma these days on stay-at-home wives.
Right, there is. And actually, you know, some cynics would say that as men are performing these household duties, perhaps the household duties will become more prestigious. Yeah, I think, I mean, some argue that men, when they stay home, actually get praised more than women do for being progressive and nurturing. And I don't know, I think each gender can work up a fair degree of feeling stigmatized, you know, when we feel like it.
So do you think, Liza, that we are on our way, maybe this is a pendulum swing, and we're on our way to a place where ultimately men and women will earn degrees and money at essentially equivalent rates?
Yeah, I think that would be the ideal world. We may be headed for a period now, particularly with the rise in single mother households, where women, a majority of women are going to be supporting households. Ultimately, the ideal world would be where we can trade back and forth. And that will be the reality for many couples. One of them will be the leading spouse for a while. The other maybe will improve their prospects or be a stay-at-home and then be able to re-enter the workforce and pull ahead. So I do think an ideal world would be trading back and forth, but also making decisions about, you know, who in the partnership is better suited for the workplace and who might be better suited at home based on personality and affinity and, not on gender stereotype.
I wonder what we could learn by studying same-sex couples and how they manage these roles.
Well, this in some ways is the way forward, because obviously same-sex couples, when they're apportioning these roles, don't rely on gender stereotypes, and they're more likely to partner outside boundaries of race and class and education level, more likely to, quote-unquote, you know, marry up or marry down or marry out or whatever, and then within the relationship, more likely to make decisions based on affinity and talent and skills and inclination rather than stereotypical notions. It's not to say that earnings don't sometimes matter. I mean, we saw that in that movie, The Kids Are All Right, where the woman who's the breadwinner has a tendency to be sort of condescending and the stay-at-home partner is going through an identity crisis. But generally, same-sex couples are better at talking about those tensions and making decisions based on, you know, true affinity.
Washington Post reporter Liza Mundy is a current fellow at the New America Foundation. Her new book is called The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. Liza, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was great to talk to you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.